This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Good day, greetings, hello. It's Art at the End of the World, the podcast that features artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. And my name is Mark Wigmore. Welcome to another edition of Remix. And it's a conversation I am thrilled to share with you as we have fresh news on my guest, classical jazz world musician Ron Davis. Ron was nominated for a Juno Award at the upcoming ceremony in Saskatchewan. Very exciting. And the name of the game here is to take our conversations from the first season of the show, done very much do-it-yourself style from my home office, and remix the episode for the purposes of our Zoomer Podcast Network and the new Classical FM presenting this version of the show. So glad to have you here. Thrilled to have Ron on. And a reminder that Art at the End of the World is brought to you by Crow's Theatre, one of the country's most acclaimed arts organizations and based in Toronto's vibrant East End community. Crow's Theatre creates unforgettable productions that examine and illuminate the pivotal narratives of our times. CrowsTheatre.com for info and tickets. And Secret Life of a Mother continues at Crow's this week from playwright Hannah Moscovich. We're also sponsored by Red Eye Media, a leading arts and entertainment communications company working with award-winning clients including Crow's Theatre, the Musical Stage Company, Summerworks Performance Festival, and others. RedEyeMedia.ca to learn more about that team. All right, so Ron Davis, here's a little introduction for you. Well, I can only say so much about Ron that can equal his prowess and thoughtfulness and creativity as a writer, composer, teacher, and piano player. Really outstanding. What a career. He's also just a great guy to pal around with and shoot the breeze. Ron and I have known each other for the better part of 20 years. We've hung out as friends. We've spoken as arts contemporaries, but it's always interesting to speak to him in a longer format and really dig into what he does and what he thinks and how he arrived at the music he creates. Ron's parents survived the Holocaust and moved to Toronto in the 1940s. And he's really been a Toronto guy his whole life, growing up here in the city. It's a little unusual. So often we hear from people who move to this city. That's not the case for Ron. He starts in music, playing piano at the Royal Conservatory, very passionate about it. And then goes to law school. He studied French at the U of T, received his PhD, and worked on this incredible thesis. And then at some point, within all that, the French and the law and the rest of it, he came back to music and has gone on to release a dozen records or so. And he'll certainly speak to that in this conversation. I first met Ron, I'm going to guess, around 2001 or two, working at CFRB in Toronto, another radio station. And I was really impressed with his playing and just a very affable guy. And it seems like every time I hear him, he's adding a new element or pushing the orchestrations or including world music themes or just melting all the music he's studied into a new form. His ensemble is often known as Symphronica, and they will be performing this Saturday night, 8 p.m. at the 918 Bathurst Centre for Culture and Arts in downtown Toronto. And then again on Saturday, May 23rd at the same location. Tickets and info at bemusednetwork.com and rondavismusic.com. He's up for Best Instrumental Album of the Year at the Junos with a record you're going to hear from in moments, Symphronica, up front. An exciting artist. I was thrilled when he agreed to sit down with me for this podcast. I think it's actually the first podcast we recorded for this whole series. He lives in a church that's been renovated in downtown Toronto for residential use, and that is where we sat down at his dining room table. Here's Ron Davis on Art at the End of the World.
I have never bought or owned a car in all my life.
Is that true?
It is true.
Why?
I'm proud of it.
Why? Really?
Yeah, man.
From what perspective?
Well, perspective that I've saved a lot of money.
Well, that, I like that. You know what? I was just reading that the other day, that the number one way to save money, you know, for millennials and everybody who's complaining because they can't make a go of it, just lose the car.
Lose the car, dude. And especially now, I mean, I came up through it in the hard times back in the day when they didn't have car sharing or bike sharing.
Back in the 80s, right?
Yeah, way back.
I think 70s?
Around the time of Confederation. And so, yeah, like walking, I'm a walkaholic.
Yeah.
And so that helped. And yeah.
Tens of thousands of dollars in your pocket.
I'm gonna see your tens of thousands and raise them to maybe hundreds. Over, like, you know, I'm not a young guy, right?
Pretty good. You could have fooled me.
Yeah.
Ron Davis is on the podcast, everybody. Smattering of applause right there. Yeah. There
wow. He is. How did you get Ron Davis? What about me? I feel so marginalized.
Just lately, in the last few records, Ron ends up as part of album titles over and over again. So I'm driving on my way here, and I think to myself, I like, you know, he puts Ron in these titles, and I kind of like that, and I could maybe give him a little hard time about that. But no, this man, classical, jazz, world music, so many influences. What you do, what you've done in the music marketplace over the last 20, 30 years, it's very specific to you. Does that feel reasonable to point out?
It does. I wish you would give me a hard time. We could have fun with this. Actually,
Symphronica up front. It's a lot of Ron in there.
And Mark Wigmore, what city am I a native of?
Toronto.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And by the way, I just had a blog review come out of my release show, and this fellow, he's English, and he has that English dry sense of humor, says, I didn't know what to make of this Ron Davis fellow. I thought he was either a singer or, with his name in the title, a megalomaniac. But it turns out, and then he says all sorts of nice things.
All right.
So I wrote a piece based on George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, over a decade ago.
Right.
And for some reason, I had the Jetsons in mind. Remember the Jetsons?
Of course.
You know, futuristic, kind of Futurama before there was Matt Groening. Right?
I guess you could say that the Jetsons theme and the Simpsons theme maybe have something in common, like this sort of bombastic fun.
You know. I never thought of that. That's actually quite brilliant. But so when I was thinking of the Jetsons, remember everything was a Tron. It was like the Oven Tron or the Rhythmatron or something. So yeah. I wrote this song based on the old jazz standard I Got Rhythm, and I called it Rhythmatron. And it was just the Jetsons thing. And it was the great arranger and pianist and musician Tanya Gill who said, oh, you put your name in Rhythmatron. And I said, I did. And ever since then, I've kind of been intrigued to put my name in songs. So there's Symphronica or the new album is Up Front.
Up Front.
Yeah, the last album was Rhythmatron.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, there is a great jazz tradition of doing that. So go back and look at Art Pepper's albums.
Sure.
Or Lee Konitz with all the...
You know, plays on last names.
Yeah,
and,
or, well, know. No, he Lee Konitz like did all the adverbs. Did he do Emotionally? He might have done Emotionally. Or,
but we even think of like a Monk's Dream or something.
Monk's Dream.
Sure.
So I'm going to plead... innocent with the name thing. And
do you feel okay? So jazz tradition, but you know, I did mention it off the top, classical, world music, especially on this new record. Have you often found, as you're, you know, looking to figure out your next gig, what the next record is going to sound like, that you do have this kind of specific place in the music landscape that's out there? I mean, you don't want to sound stereotypical, but it is hard to compartmentalize on some level what you do.
Absolutely. It is not intentional. I just do what I do. The arts have a history of people who are one of a kind.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I'm like that, but whether it's Freddie Mercury or actually a name that often comes to mind, it sounds crazy, is Gilbert Gottfried, right? Like there's only one Gilbert Gottfried. And I don't know about Gilbert Gottfried or Freddie Mercury, but I do know about me. This is what I do. You're supposed to make music and you're supposed to make the music you find inside. And this is what comes out. And then I learn through comparison that I make and through comments that other people make that, oh, this is different. And it's great, you know, the arts and the world at large, but the world of the arts is a funny world because on the one hand, uniqueness is celebrated. How often in biographies or reviews do we see unique, one of a kind? But at the same time, uniqueness is also partly marginalized because the great paradox of the arts is people want something totally new, as long as it sounds exactly the same as everything else.
Yeah, that's very true. We repackage over and over again, and all you need to do is be around long enough so that you can actually hear that happen.
Yeah, I'm hanging out for that legend status. It's right.
So what, 17 records?
Well, thanks. No, it's not 17 yet. It's 12.
12.
12, yeah. A dozen. And I hope
pretty good.
13. And what I'm most proud of is that each of my 12 records over a span of 16 years is different. I've never done the same thing twice. And actually, it's interesting. Some people value that. I value that. It's just what I do.
I value it, too.
Thank you. Yeah. But there's some people who don't like it.
I mean, I will say, and I'll go all the way back to the beginning with you, which is about 18 years ago, 16 years ago, maybe. I'm working at News Talk 1010 CFRB, and this record lands on my desk, and I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, this guy's pretty good. I mean, I really am digging it. And I think we had you on with John Donaby.
Yeah.
We started out.
On
we
just 7:30 on a Saturday morning.
Well, I think it was just like a straight up, we did a regular interview, and then I booked you on for John's birthday, and you came in and you played us in and out of breaks and everything, and it was really fun, and that was so great. But I have often thought of how much I listened to those first couple records, and sometimes with I love everything new, but I do, I love those. You know, they hold a certain place in my heart, and of course, you know, I think that's what you do with music, right? You have certain records that really stick with you because you were at a certain place in your life, and of course you were doing something specific, so it was like that perfect marriage, you know.
Yeah, no, and I've heard it said, and I actually believe that the music of your life is fixed by the time you're 30,
right?
And it doesn't mean you're not going to listen to new stuff, and it doesn't mean you're not going to like new stuff,
right?
But I find myself having to discipline myself.
You do have to push yourself.
Yeah, you have to push yourself to listen to the new stuff, and then you kind of fall back on the old stuff. I mean, look at the heritage rock, you know, the museum rock industry, you know, people filling stadiums to go see music, essentially live versions of albums that are 20, 30, 40, not 50. Well, yeah, 50 years old.
It's one last party before it's all over.
Kind of, but there are lots of one last parties where, like, even in a city like Toronto, but elsewhere, there's great live music happening. So, you know, it's great that we can be nostalgic, although nostalgia isn't what it used to be. Insert rimshot there.
Sure isn't.
And on the other hand, I just keep making music I believe in, and I have to tell you, the new record that I made is the first one that was ever produced by someone else, by the great Mike Downs.
Got Mike Downs on there, who's seemingly very busy.
He's very busy, and he's the best. It's a cliche, but it's so true. I'm so proud of it. Like, for people who have children, I don't have children that I know of, but for people who do have children, it's you watch your child grow and you're so proud of your child and the achievement. This album is I'm so proud of it.
What I like about it too is as much as it's a departure from earlier records, it's also each track takes you on its own little journey, which I really do love about that record.
Yeah, funny you should say that because in the concert version of the recording, I've been telling the audience that it's exactly what you just said, mm-hmm. a journey. And we go to Latin America for these rhythms, or we go to Italy for the song I do with my wife, Daniela, Nina, or we go to the heart of American jazz and just travel all around. And people connect with that, I think. People like the idea of a journey.
Yeah.
And that's what all art, but especially music, should be. Like, I'm inviting you, the listener, into my space, into my world, into my home, and I'm going to give you a little tour, and I'm going to tell you a little story, except I'm only going to do it with musical notes. I'm not going to do it with words, which makes our challenge in instrumental music just a little harder. And that's what you go for.
Let's go back to your journey a little bit. I mean, one of the elements within your life that I think is fascinating is that you actually are a Torontonian. There's so few that have been here most of their lives. And is that true? You came up here in Toronto, is that right?
I was born in Toronto.
Seems unbelievable. And here we are in Toronto.
I'm actually going to put in my candidacy to be pickled in the Museum of Toronto as a rare resident born in Toronto. And even more unusual is the fact that my wife, the great musician and artist Daniela Nardi, was born and raised in Toronto.
So homegrown. Tell me about your upbringing. What neighborhood did you grow up? What was it like? Your parents, I know, immigrants and had gone through a difficult time in their lives. So I think that brings a certain mood to a kid growing up and a family growing up. But it is the story of so many Torontonians who are coming from different parts of the world. So tell us a little bit about growing up and that experience.
Well, I grew up in the Dufferin and Glencairn area of Toronto. And if you know Toronto, so it was, I call it the southern part of North York, literally on the wrong side of the tracks of a more high-end area called Forest Hill.
Right.
It was very much an immigrant neighborhood, mostly Italians, a few Jewish families. There was one West Indian family who lived there. And my parents, and this is the part that connects so closely with what's going on today, my parents were refugees.
Right.
They survived the Nazi concentration camps and had their families murdered and found themselves in a refugee camp in Austria, and that was run by the American Army in the 1940s.
Is that something they were able to talk about? Or?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Quite openly. Actually, yes, that's an extremely astute question, Mark, because many people, refugees today or refugees back then, were not or are not able to discuss the traumas that they go through. My parents were quite open about it. It was actually to a fault because, you know, growing up, I would hear my mother say, "Oh, I was in camp with her." And usually when you hear "I was in camp with someone," you have visions of the bucolic summer scene.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite what my mother meant.
Not at all.
But they were able to talk about it. So, you know, they came here as refugees, and it's the refugee immigrant story. They had nothing. My father went down to Spadina, which was a manufacturing district, and convinced someone that he'd be a good worker and started scrubbing and cleaning and then worked his way up to have a little factory. And so I was raised from a poorer class to a middle class upbringing as my father toiled. And
you actually experienced that change?
I got the tail end of it. I'm the third of three brothers, and so my older brothers experienced that slow rise from a small rented apartment for the family to a bungalow in what was then an almost distant suburb of Toronto. It's by the Glencairn subway station,
right,
before it was built. So, but what I did get is that work ethic. I mean, my father was up at 4 a.m, and, you know, and my mother, who was a classic housewife, would be cleaning every day or making chicken soup from stock. Yeah, not from stock, from scratch.
Right,
rather.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I was raised with that. And of course, you'll appreciate, and maybe other children of immigrants who hear this will appreciate that. When I started babbling about music as a career, my parents thought that the apocalypse had come and would probably think of, I don't know, fleeing to a distant planet rather than have their son become a jazz musician.
But did they not look at the great lineage and heritage of music within, you know, Jewish culture? And there's certainly been a fair share of success stories within that world, but that was not what they had planned for you. No,
the only thing they knew about the great lineage and heritage in certain parts of Jewish culture was the lawyers, the accountants, and the doctors. That's funny because they kind of squeezed me into getting a law degree, and that's a whole That's a whole podcast in itself,
right?
On how that happened.
But at that point, you had already been to the conservatory and so on. You had definitely gone down the path of music by the time you.
Yeah, I had already started doing gigs then, and I had studied with. This is in the 70s when there weren't the jazz programs were just beginning, and it wasn't the norm to get a degree in jazz. And so
it's almost like taking classes for stand-up comedy or something like that. Like you wouldn't. It just wasn't done at the time.
Yes, but there was a teacher in Toronto, and every chance I get to give a shout out to Darwin Aiken, I do. And Darwin taught Joe Seeley and Aaron Davis and Nancy Walker. So I'd been studying with this great teacher, Darwin Aiken, and I had already started doing gigs, and that's when I got sidetracked into law.
I mean, was there any joy in that path? Yeah, I didn't actually really know that much about that side of your life until recently. So it's sort of fascinating to me. But you went down the path. Clearly, your parents put some pressure on you to do it. I mean, you must have mixed feelings about the whole experience now.
Well, going backwards in time, I do practice law part-time.
Right.
I'm quite privileged to have it. I mean, there is almost no one in the music business and in the arts in general who doesn't do something else.
Sure.
People teach, or people do film music or commercial music, or do interior decorating or project management. I have this law degree that I have to recognize as a privilege. And I also have the privilege of actually being a partner in a downtown Toronto law firm, Fogler Rubinoff, and they're very tolerant of my ways. So my running joke is that 30% of my time is law and 70% of my income. 70% of my time is music and 30% of my income, which is the way of the music business.
Almost like you saw ahead and really thought, well.
Well, my parents did. I mean, you know, an actor once said, who was down on his luck at the time once said, and this actor was down on his luck, did not have a fallback. You know, at best, he could be a server in a restaurant, you know, but nothing in the professions. And he was asked, are you sorry that you didn't get a law degree or have anything to fall back on? And the actor said, no, I may be down on my luck, but if you have something to fall back on, then you fall back on it.
Right.
So I'll never know. I'm privileged to have the law degree, but I make most of my life in music, and that's the greater privilege. Although there's another way of looking at it. If I had gone through with my law degree, which I had for a few decades now, conservatively, I would have had, let's say, $100,000 a year salary, right?
Right.
So I got my called to the bar 32 years ago. Multiply that by 100,000. This freaking music career has caught me millions of dollars. It's the most expensive thing I've ever done.
But you've enjoyed it very much.
This is true.
Very much
this
so.
This is true.
I just want to bring this up because it was fascinating to me. Something that during your studies, I read this, and I don't know if I got this exactly right, but chronosemantics.
Sorry.
The study of time and meaning. Is that, have I got that right? What that is?
You do. Yes. So you have just named the title of my doctoral thesis at the University of Toronto, which I'm honored to say won an award, actually.
Yeah, wow.
Thesis of the year. And
we'll take these awards as they come.
Yo, baby, bring them on.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what my doctoral thesis was about. I'm so impressed that you found that. By the way, I have an extra copy here if you want to take it home, digital.
My guess is you have an extra 20 to 30 copies maybe kicking around.
Now, you know, you're a wise man.
You can, you know, just have them in the merch pile just in case.
I'm waiting for Hollywood to come knocking for the film version.
Chronosemantics. You know?
Come on, dude.
Here it is.
I'm thinking Ryan Gosling, right?
And it sounds like it could be a Netflix series as opposed to just the 90-minute arc of a film, right?
Okay, that's I can work with that. But as long as, like, maybe J.J. Abrams did it, or
It's true. You need the last guy.
I got to get something.
Now, that sounds fascinating, but at the same time, it sounds like a lot of hard work.
It was labor, but it wasn't work, and in the sense that it was next to learning piano and becoming a musician. It's by far the hardest thing I've done. Law pales next to a doctoral thesis of that kind. But you know
what? Time, space, and meaning.
Time, well, not space, just time.
Right.
So it was even more difficult. Right. And let me tell you, well, it's actually a bit in the zeitgeist. Again, no pun intended, because Zeit, of course, is a German word for time.
Right.
But in the zeitgeist at the moment, people are reexamining the question of time. And as we sit here today, Mark Wigmore, I will tell you without any hesitation and with absolute confidence, we do not know what time is. It's a mystery. We know it's there. And St. Augustine, in his Confessions, actually says the exact same thing. He starts wondering, what is time? What is this phenomenon that we all know? And his conclusion is, I know it's there. I know what it is when I'm talking about it, but I can't explain what it
right,
is.
Right.
So it's a great mystery.
There's a measurement we created for it. And it feels like different lengths. And so there's a lot of perspective involved. And I guess those were all the types of experiences and elements that you were trying to kind of put together. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is fair to say. The closest I came to any definition, I mean, when you try and define time, you usually get stuck at before and after.
Right.
It's hard to define before and after other than some synonym for before and after. But then you realize time is many things because, yes, you can measure it, but there are types of time that you can't measure because we've all done something for 1 minute that seems like an hour,
right,
and something for 1 hour that seems like a minute. And that's beyond measurement. And it's a huge topic, and there's some great books coming out. Even James Gleick, the famous American author, science author, who's writes popular books, but profound books on science, has just released a book on time. So, but we never quite figured it out. And
No
one has a good explanation of time. It's just right. That they have workable methods of talking about time. And if you really want to seal the deal, we also don't know what meaning is.
Right.
Meaning just presents itself. And that's why I did a thesis on time and meaning, because time is in language and it's there. We know it's there, just don't know what it is. But meaning is available to us. We understand there's meaning, but there's no actual workable theory on what meaning is.
That incredible field that you studied, I mean, have you felt like that's something you've been able to incorporate into your music life?
Everything is the music, Mark.
Right.
Everything is the music.
Sure.
And so I recognize my academic background as informing a lot of the music that I do. But sitting down with Mark Wigmore in his podcast studio or...
We're in your house, by the way. I just broke that wall.
Oh, damn.
It's a nice house.
I was trying to create the illusion. Yes. Yep. Well, if we're gonna go at it, this house is an old Anglican church.
Right.
So we are sitting right in the middle of what was an Anglican church, looking one way at the entrance and looking the other way at the altar.
If your parents could see you now.
Oh, my gosh. Praise the Lord. But everything is music, dude,
yeah.
Including not owning a car.
Yeah.
Including a doctoral thesis and a law degree. And if you're Charlie Parker, those bar mitzvah gigs he used to do, or cleaning dishes while listening to Art Tatum, that he used to do in a restaurant,
yeah,
it's everything's the music.
You are listening to Art at the End of the World. I'm Mark Wigmore. My conversation with Ron Davis continues in a moment. You're listening to the Zoomer Podcast Network. Let's get back to our Art at the End of the World remix episode and talk to Ron Davis about how the world around us has affected his writing and composing throughout his career. It's a crazy world out there right now. A political discourse, tribalism. So often I talk to jazz musicians and I ask them where they got the ideas for their song. And it's like, well, it's just a great melody. And we put that together. And yeah, we worked off that. And I go, oh, okay. I always expect that there might be some greater story there or a moment of time that really helped them formulate an idea of maybe for an entire album or for a particular song. I mean, where do you stand there? Is it just about, okay, I think I've got something here tonally that works, or are you actually affected by
the wild world that we're in, and that we can hear something of that in your music. I mean, I'm guessing with this new record specifically, where there are a lot of world influences, that may be the case, but I don't know.
Yeah, sure. There are some times when a song will come through because an interesting chord progression, but more often than not, I'm searching for something. And there's a song on the new recording on Symphonica Up Front called Les Angéliques, The Angelicals. Mm-hmm. And it stemmed from a poem by the great Quebecois poet Émile Nelligan. And it's just a short poem about him walking in the 19th century in the snowy woods of Quebec and how beautiful it was. And I thought, how beautiful that is. And then I decided, I want to capture a moment of beauty. I want to create something that is slow and timeless and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that's how that song came about.
And I know you've composed or worked on music that with your parents in mind.
Yeah, so there you go. On the previous recording, Pockets in Fronica, there's a song called Hatzal Seder Pesach, and that is a melody that comes from the Passover Seder tradition that my father used to sing at the table during Passover Seders. And so I always thought, as I was growing up and then into my 20s and beyond, I would hear that song and a little voice in my head would say, oh man, wouldn't that be awesome if some jazz musician or Coltrane did it? And it took me far too long, you know, for the for a guy with university degrees ought to have taken to realize, hey, I can do that.
Wait a second.
Yeah, duh. And
But it's more than that. I think there's an emotional attachment to
totally.
That. And to invest in the way that you do creatively, that takes its own little confidence step.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's there, that connection is there.
Sure.
I'll give you
I want to step into that?
Well, I mean, if you're in the arts, you're fearless. You better be fearless.
Yeah.
And by fearless, I mean just so stupid you don't even pay attention.
Right.
So I just step into all this stuff. But the next recording, which I hope will happen, but certainly the third concert of my Symphronica season in Toronto, so on May 23rd, it comes very much from a place of searching, and it's called the Instrumental Liberation Front. And 5 years ago, on the Jazz FM website, I published a manifesto called The Instrumental Liberation Front, a Manifesto.
Right.
And so this cause...
It seems like your wife and you are both into manifestos to some degree.
Touché. Hers is an espresso manifesto. Mine isn't as caffeinated. Mine is more territorial.
Right.
And it's about instrumental music and how instrumental music has been marginalized by the corporatization and by the commercialization and processing of music. I'm not the only one to complain about this. So in May, I'm doing this show, Instrumental Liberation Front. I hope to do a recording. And it is going to replant the flag for instrumental music. And the music that we are doing, I mean, we're doing this already, but this particular show, this particular concept, shines a light on the engagement with and the production of instrumental music as a perfectly valid and desirable form of music that is a part of Western music history that we are now in the process of losing. So when you talk about, you know, more than just finding an interesting chord pattern in the music, everything that comes out in that show is about engaging with notes and sounds, but also engaging with the world and being the medium and being the intermediate, or as the academics like to say, to mediate between the music and the world and the listener.
I was watching a tribute to Grammy. It was a Lifetime award for Grammy winners, and it was the big special they did on PBS. And I was noting that they were celebrating the Wrecking Crew, the guys who did a lot of backing up of people like the Beach Boys and Frank Sinatra and so on, Tijuana Brass, Booker T and the MGs, the Meters, right? And I thought to myself, those guys all had hits.
They were top 40.
And there's no vocals.
They were top 40.
And it kind of broke my heart to see that ship really disappearing on the horizon of music in a very popular format because it's so wonderful, you know. And those are just pop examples, but
yeah, and there are others. I mean, even Herbie Hancock.
True.
And you just mentioned examples from the 60s and 70s, which is when instrumental music began to be marginalized. Go back to the 50s,
sure,
and then we're talking about jazz. You know, jazz was the pop music.
Well, right.
You know, but now words take over everything. You could have 1,000 instruments. If you have one singer, it's vocal music, and it wins. So the Instrumental Liberation Front, you heard it here first, Mark Wigmore, and listeners to Mark Wigmore's great podcast.
I'll ask you this because I think Art Tatum was kind of one of your guys. Is that fair to say?
I'm going to pause here for a moment while I go on my knees and genuflect before the naming of the deity, Art Tatum.
You were a monk person as well, big time.
Yes, yes.
Stumbling down the keyboard with Monk. I mean, what was that listening spectrum as you were starting to really get into this part of your life?
It was completely intuitive. It was bottom up. It was never top down. It was never for me a case of reading a book on what you should be listening to or who the canonic greats of jazz or any music are.
I think that comes later. I don't know how anybody could really get into music from a book. I think you're always just going to have that relationship where something punches you in the face or it makes your hair stand on end, and that ends up being your person.
I'd like to agree, and to me that is the ideal scenario,
right.
But I have noticed with the increasing academization of music, with its greater scholarly setting that it finds itself in. I mean, the music programs in universities are bigger and bigger and forever growing. I feel there actually is a top-down orthodoxy.
I understand.
Especially
a learned appreciation.
A learned appreciation.
Right. And I understand that too, because, you know, especially in the classical world, there are so many references, both what it's doing with melody and what it's nodding to from, you know, like any art form with a long lineage, there's always going to be these nods. And that's fun to discover and it's fascinating. But hearing Jimi Hendrix solo and all along the Watchtower can, you know, have its own mark on your psyche, and so it should.
It's true. I mean, I do observe in jazz, though, a creeping orthodoxy where jazz has become a classical music in some senses,
sure,
not in all senses.
Right.
And it's interesting. You just mentioned Jimi Hendrix, but even in that case, he's become a bit of an orthodoxy.
Right.
I mean, I'm with you 100%. It's mind blowing. If asked, I would tell a young listener or someone trying to discover jazz, yeah, listen to Monk or listen to Tatum and listen to Jimi Hendrix or not.
Yeah.
And in my own case, in my playing or my music, I may have my own brand, but where I've noticed my difference is in my listening. Because if you ask me to list my go-tos and my influences, they're often different or they only overlap partially with the others.
Sure.
Bill Evans, for example, is probably the most influential jazz pianist of his era. There was a poll in Downbeat not long ago, and not necessarily the greatest, because in that same poll, 100 pianists named Art Tatum as the greatest, but Bill Evans as the most influential.
Right.
And
he certainly could set a mood.
And he was fantastic. I mean, like, he was a genius in every way, but he has no influence, very little influence on me whatsoever.
Right.
And what I'd like to think is that there are jazz players out there who, even though they may know, or even though it's a fact that Bill Evans is the most influential, there are young jazz players out there who won't be influenced by Bill Evans. They might be influenced by Phineas Newborn Jr., who arguably was one of the greats, or Mary Lou Williams, or Marion McPartland, and that would be okay. I'm worried that there's an orthodoxy that says it is top-down, and if you're not influenced by Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, and Bill Evans, then I'm not really going to listen to you.
For me, it ended up being a lot of the fame. You know, I would hear these names. I would read about them. I remember getting this book when I was a kid, and it just had, you know, little biographies on various famous musicians from various genres. And I would be very much like, oh, well, I guess I better listened to this. And I don't know what your experience was or how you came to it, because I didn't have an older brother or something saying, oh yeah, check this out or what have you. It was more, I had to do a little bit of studying, listen to those people, see what I thought, and then kind of make a decision.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And have those decisions stayed with you?
Yeah. I mean, I liked what I liked. And of course, I've spent my entire career talking about trying to play a little bit of music, certainly listening to it, going to concerts. It's a huge part of my life. But when I think about how it all came together, you know, I remember even getting, the 15 cassettes for the penny thing, you know, and literally picking out those names that were 20, 30 years old at the time, just because I had kind of heard about these people. And I thought I should really, you know, eat my Brussels sprouts and figure out who some of these people are. And I was able to say, well, I really like that. And, you know, this I could leave. What about you? How did that come?
Parenthetically, I love the Brussels sprout analogy. I remember someone once going to see a jazz concert, and that was totally theoretical and not really about the music. And he walked out and he told me, "I was totally broccoli, man, all broccoli."
Broccoli. Yeah. I understand completely.
I understand exactly.
I went and saw Ornette Coleman one time, and I thought that was sort of an eat your Brussels sprouts moment, you know?
And by the way, that's a bit of, no pun intended, a beef, that I have with some of the music, is that, oh my God, like jazz, like classical music, can get so theoretical. Right. I wonder if that's going to happen to rock or pop. Can you imagine like going to a rock concert and it's like, they're doing all the correct things.
I mean, I have seen King Crimson several times. So yes, I can sort of imagine that.
You know? No comment. I'm angling for a tour with King Crimson, so I will not.
Me and Frippers, real close here. Yeah. So, yeah.
You know what? I don't know if this will resonate with you, but my heuristic, my way into the music from, you know, from nowhere, from the desert of ignorance into the garden of knowledge was the public library, which kind of was, the public library was like the internet before the internet.
So sure was. Yeah.
Before there was an internet, so we're talking about the 70s, public library had these record collections, and you could go in and you can borrow 5 to 10 records a week.
Sign them out.
Yeah.
After you look at the microfiche.
There was a microfiche.
Sure.
Yeah. This is true.
Grab a few actual books.
Remember those?
Yeah.
And they were made from a substance called paper.
But, the library with actual vinyl in it, I mean, in some ways, I mean, there's vinyl stores still to
there
this
are
day, which
stores.
Is nice. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there is an equivalent to the library, and that is SoundCloud or you know, Spotify free account or whatever. Right. You can, instead of taking the records home and dropping the needle, and if you didn't like them, you turn to the library, you drop the needle on your Spotify account. The only issue with Spotify is you might drop the needle and get out too quickly.
I went and saw Brian Eno speak about 10 years ago at the AGO, and he said something that really resonated with me, and it stuck with me ever since, and that is, options are the enemy. And it's so true, because I do think in our current media landscape as it is, sometimes that canvas is just too big. No direction there, and you have to make a decision what you're going to put on. And I do think that sometimes, you know, the limited resources of your own personal collection were what was available at the library. You were better off. You know, I don't know that humans are capable of reaching into the abyss that is available to us now.
Yeah, choice is completely paralytic.
Yeah,
it's and you know, I'll go on. I don't have a Spotify, kind of Google Music Play,
sure.
But I go on there and it's like
one of those.
Yeah. Where the heck do I start?
Yeah.
I mean, there's too much choice.
Uh-huh.
Daniela knows about me that I can't go shopping, because if there are more than three things to choose from, I won't buy anything. But you know what? We may be having I'm a little older than you, but I'm thinking of Gen X or millennials who may be different from us in that they're just more capable of dealing with a wider array of choice.
Either that, or there's some sort of revolt against the current wave of infinite digital possibilities and the crass, dumbed down world of social media that we're exploring now. I would like to think that there ends up being some sort of correction and all of that.
I think you're right. I think that's an astute observation. I think at least among the millennial and Gen X and Gen Y cohort that I know, They're getting it together and they realize, like, you know, this isn't everything at all times available 24/7 is not necessarily a good thing.
It was fun to fantasize about briefly.
Yeah.
But exactly. Now that we have it, I don't know that it's been a particular help or has done much for us. What was available to you at the library was a good starting point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and so I could discover this new artist, Joni Mitchell, or I could discover a fellow by the name of Debussy, who I later learned was Debussy.
Yeah, that's right.
And
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then, I mean, the thunderclap was, I actually did not know the name, but there was this record by a guy named Art Tatum. And they had a nice cover. So I took it home. He's a piano player. I could tell that. And I put it on. And the first track on that particular album was a song called Tiger Rag. And people might even recognize it. Sometimes hear in advertisements, hold that tiger, da, 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 da. So I recognized the name of the song and I dropped the needle on the vinyl LP. And in 2.5 minutes, my world was changed. And here we are decades later. And that track, A, still knocks my socks off. And any listening pianist and maybe any person who loves music would have their socks knocked off. And it's still as great as ever. And so that kind of discovery and that type of thunderclap moment, which happened over and over and over again through the library, shaped where I am today.
It's been fun for me to speak to people over the years who do have a unique love of both jazz and classical music, and it forms these very specific careers. You talk about Debussy and Tatum sort of coming at you at the same time, and certainly you've taken both formats into account in your studies and somewhat what we hear out of your records. I like it very much. I mean, there's a beautiful marriage there if it done properly.
Well, thank you. I mean, coming from you, that really is an honor. And it's sincere. I don't will it. It's just what comes out naturally. But I have to say this, what I especially love about millennial culture and where music and listening has gone in the past 20 years is the knocking down of borders. I come from a generation where pigeonholes were pigeonholes and they were hard silos and the verticals were the verticals. But especially with the coming of the iPad, the iPod, uh-huh. to go back to the 90s, but now it's streaming. And really to go back to that younger cohort that I know, but some of the older cohort, but mostly the younger cohort, it's music without borders.
Right.
So many playlists will have a bit of Debussy, a bit of Art Tatum, some of Kendrick Lamar, some Robert Glasper, Joni Mitchell, and then you know, lather, rinse, repeat, and you're into another cycle with a bit of everything. And that is really cool, and that's what really works for me.
You're describing ADD in a in some format there, but I know exactly what you mean.
How many ADHDs does it take to change a light bulb? Want to go see a movie? Thank you.
There it is.
Insert the rim shot again.
Tell me.
By the way, just on that point, I got to add, I had this wonderful review of our show in the Scotsman, kind of one of Scotland's national newspapers, last summer, and they came up with this term that I'd been unknowingly looking for decades, and I think describes what I do: wayward eclecticism.
Nice.
Yeah, he called it a wonderfully wayward eclecticism. And so, yeah, it is ADHD, but at the same time, it's eclectic. And that can be a bad term. Some jazz purists have come up to me and said, I don't like what you do. It's too all over the place.
Right.
That's cool, you know.
But
for me, I like the music without borders approach.
Was there a moment ever in this last 20 years as you've been putting out records where you thought, I don't know if I can keep going on with this, or I'm out of ideas. I my love for this is being tried by consistently having to create. What's been your
has there ever been a moment when I questioned that? But the question really should be, has there ever been a moment when that hasn't been the case?
Yeah,
every inch of music that I do or I make, every inch of every performance is can I keep doing this? And I have to tell you, there is no musician, no artist worth their salt that isn't thinking that. If you go to a performance, or if you listen to a recording or see a film or piece of work from an artist who isn't struggling every single minute with that question, it's like, oh my God, this is so hard, then guarantee you, you will be bored. If you've ever gone to a concert and walked out and haven't felt the love, or just felt that like, wow, like the playing was great, but I was unmoved, it's because they're not feeling that at the moment. Right. Because they're not leaving every bit of their innards on the floor. So even people who come to my shows and don't like really care for the music, they get something out of it. And it's not just me. I mean, this is whoever. We're all struggling. And actually, the way it plays out in the music world, I gotta say this, like, especially for listeners who aren't musicians, because non-musicians will come up to us, and you've probably had this too, Mark, you know, being in broadcasting and being in the arts. People, non-listeners will come up to us, and all they want to talk about is music. They heard this great album, I saw this great concert, sure. did you see the new Pat Metheny thing?
Me talking to my uncle when I was 15, yeah.
It's the best thing. But when you put the musicians in the room, what do we talk about? The last thing we talk about is the music.
Right.
All we talk about, oh, I only got this on that gig. Oh, this is so hard. I should have got a law degree. And so, yeah, we're all about that.
What artist brings you comfort? I'm at that age now where we were talking about this earlier, where, you know, it is a little harder to keep figuring out, you know, who's the next artist I'm going to totally fall in love with, who's the latest new thing that I've got time for, and so on. But lately, I like even yesterday, I brought up my collection that I have in iTunes that I actually downloaded in there. And it was fun to look through because now, of course, like everybody, I have a streaming software that I use, and I just kind of blindly maybe grab at something. But it was fun to look at my collection. And lately, I've been trying to maybe pick out a few records that just make me feel good in a world that can be pretty tricky and can really get you down. I'd be fascinated to know what's the comfort record for you? Puts your soul at ease.
I'm just trying to sort through which Coltrane record.
Right.
Probably John Coltrane and Johnny Hartman. Right. There I go. I picked a vocal record. So yeah. I'm going to back off of that.
No, that's fair. I mean,
no, actually,
he had an interesting vocal style, that guy. I mean, it's
Johnny
not,
Hartman
not
did.
For everybody, but
it's not for everybody. But you know, I'm going to, I lied. Just lied because, as much as I love Johnny Hartman and John Coltrane, really my go-to album from John Coltrane,
Sonship. no, that's a
no offense to the Sonship listeners,
no.
But
it's nothing,
I mean,
it's nothing comforting in that. Well,
people find their comfort in funny places.
They do,
Mark,
you know. They like that bump in the couch.
I'm telling you, I love Supreme. That is deep. You talk about music coming from somewhere other than just the chord changes.
Yeah.
That is deep.
There's something about the intro to My Favorite Things that I find
that too
blissful. It's like morning sunshine falling on my face or something, you know.
That's because you're a Mary Poppins fan. Come on, just confess. But, you know, I mean, equally, you know, for comfort, Art Tatum and Buddy DeFranco, the clarinetist, like, beautiful, but also Yasha Heifetz playing the Bach solo violin pieces.
Yeah.
I'm a great devotee of Glenn Gould. In fact, Glenn Gould has been a huge influence in my life.
I was going to bring him up because I know you've been intimate with his music and some of the organizations involved with him. But
yes, he is. Yeah. I like to say he is the great palm print in the wet cement of my adolescent mind. And, you know, there are various albums by Glenn Gould. He's known for his Bach, but he did an album of the music of Johannes Brahms, which is so meltingly beautiful.
Is he talking? Can you hear him chatting away in the background?
You hear him singing away if right. you listen very closely.
Right.
But if you're really listening, you only hear the music.
Mm-hmm.
Funny, Mike Downs, to get back to him, wrote a great tune for the new album Up Front called La Côte d'Or. And it's such an earworm. I told Mike, I hate you, Mike, because it's like such an earworm that I found myself actually humming the song when I've been playing it in public. And
right.
I guess that just happens.
Yeah. Well, that's that's a sign of a good thing, I would
think. I guess. It might be annoying to the audience, but I'm having fun. Right. Yeah.
Let's talk about this record a little bit. You'd been working with this outfit for a while. I'm sure you've had various members who've kind of, I don't know if it's been a rock solid membership or if you've kind of had people come and go, but what was the intention with building this? You've worked on solo piano as well, but what was the intention of building this group around you, and what has it allowed you to do, and what did it allow you to do this with this record?
First of all, can I make the observation that you are so good at what you do?
Oh boy,
it's like
sheesh.
Crazy good to listen. Like, the questions you ask are so spot on. Have you ever thought of doing this professionally? I think you really have a future in this. Those are great questions.
Wigmoresworld.com. Have a look. Get in touch right there. You probably already went there so you could listen to this.
So, intention. I had no intention, a bit like that Bugs Bunny cartoon where he gets hit over the head with an anvil when he's on a construction site. Right. And as he's about to fall off the building, another girder comes up to catch him from right. falling down.
Right.
That's kind of my existence. When I first began what became the Symphronica formation, the Symphronica group, about 15 years ago, I just loved the sound. It just felt right, you know, and although I've played solo and with saxophones, and I love my saxophone players, trumpet players, and I've recorded with them, this is what sounded right. And so I had some arrangements done and did some arrangements and picked tunes. And over the years, it's formed. And as you say, it hasn't been a solid group that's been together all the time. It actually started with two clarinets and a cello and viola and piano bass drums, and it only took its shape as the group that it is today, which is a piano and keyboard, so acoustic and electric bass, acoustic and electric guitar, drum kit and percussion, and then an acoustic string quartet, so two violins, viola, and cello. It only took that shape finally about 6 years ago. And it's at that time that Kevin Barrett, the fantastic guitarist and fantastic friend, became a solid part of this and became a music director. And this is all evolutionary. It all just happened over time. So now it does have a shape. And now Kevin is an integral part of it. And Mike Downs is the bass player. Even when he's not available, he's the main bass player. And Alin Homsey, great young violinist who could play Bach one day and then play Stefan Grappelli or Virginia Carter the next day.
And it feels like you're taking full advantage of those.
I try.
Those skills. Yeah.
It's funny. People sometimes, I hear often like, oh, you're so generous with your musicians. Thank you. But I actually think they're being generous with me because what they contribute to this, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, you'd look at bands and it's common. You look at the great Duke Ellington band and you'll talk about Johnny Hodges or Paul Gonsalves or whoever. And a band is as strong as its members.
Right.
But I just feel blessed that these great musicians.
I'll tell you something that I've noted about it is that, you know, when I think about your early records, it's really, you know, you get a real strong sense of where you're coming from and what your intention was with the compositions and the music. But here with these records, it's nice because I feel like you can go right up front in it, or you can really kind of lay back and let your players, you know, work the composition and do what they do. And so we get to hear varying levels of actual piano in the music, which is kind of nice. It shows a nice dynamic.
Well, thanks. You just used the word up front, which is the title of the album. And that's actually where it came from.
Right.
It's that, you know, you have, if you think of it in cinematic terms, you have the medium shot and then the close-up and then the long shot. And the close-ups are on different members. So, you know, I'm up front for most of the songs. It's kind of my recording, but by no means am I up front on all of them. And we take great care When I work with Kevin to put together a solo order, we take great care to try and balance things out and to play to the strengths of the musicians. And with great soloists like a Lynn Homsey or Mike Downs or Kevin Barrett and or Raphael Weinroth Brown, our cellist, even Lawrence Scheifele, our violist, which is, you don't really hear a lot of viola in jazz these days, or Brielle Goheen, our other violinist, there was a concerted effort to try and bring them up front and to share that. And, you know, I mean, ensemble pieces, right? When you have an ensemble piece, you don't, in my opinion, you don't want to go see the one person. If you've ever gone to a Shakespeare play or any play whatsoever where it's about a cast of characters and you have that one actor who's kind of hogging the spotlight, mm-hmm. It's like, okay, we get it. You're a great actor. But, you know, you're the better actor for being part of the group, right? You know, and so that's more interesting to me. I've spoken my piece. There's enough of me out there that if you really want to hear me solo, by all means, like my last recording was a solo album.
Sure.
By all means, you know, go get it. But what I love is like the group work, you know, and it's like seeing a solo dancer or seeing a whole troupe of dancers. I'll go out and do my pirouettes every so often, but isn't it cool when we're all dancing together, you know, across the stage? And I just want to dispel any notions of me in a tutu in case I've evoked
well,
that.
Well, you're wearing one right now.
Oh, so. Mark. You weren't supposed to mention that.
And you already got the next project on the go. And you know what? Even just looking at pictures, I wasn't able to be at the show last Thursday. But
you have a doctor's note, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Okay. It's here somewhere. But even just the look of that concert had a very specific tone to it. The way everybody was positioned on stage and the lighting, and it looks like it, you know, it's pretty something pretty special for you right now.
Thanks. Well, music is a visual art.
Yeah.
And even though I, pun intended, trumpet instrumental music, and I want the music to speak for itself, to music to speak for the music, I don't want the spectacle, the visual spectacle, to overtake the music. It's not enough. It's not enough just to go on stage and just play. I think that lean back experience that was the concert experience, it's not that old a concert experience. I mean, the idea of going into a hall or going into a club and sitting back and then having someone sit on stage and play is no more than, well, certainly no more than 150 years old,
right.
Maybe even just 100 years
old. It's like the old Joe Rogan joke that he just told on his latest special that he did on Netflix. That's two people ago.
That's exactly right. I'm so going to use that.
Yeah, yeah.
It is totally two people ago. So, you know, I got to make it. You're sitting there. I got to bring you in. So we do spend time on things like lighting and how the band is positioned for visuals. It's not going to be the show, mm-hmm. but it's the underwear of the show.
And you're feeling good. Otherwise, you've got this incredible latest project, and that continues. You got another project on the go. You've got your law practice. It feels like you're doing all right.
You know, I come from Jewish culture, and in Jewish culture, well, Yiddish culture.
Sure.
So Eastern European Ashkenaz culture, and in Yiddish culture, the glass isn't half empty, and the glass isn't half full. It's almost totally empty, it's cracked, there's a spot on it, and then it's about to be completely empty. So, you know, it's you can complain about everything, but when I stand back, it's a privileged life. I meet the best people. And
would mom and dad be okay with where it's all gone?
Funny story about that. So my mom was always, I could never do any wrong. My mother's only complaint was, How come Miles Davis makes so much money and you're not like Miles
Davis? You don't have a TV show.
You should be like Miles Davis. So that was her only complaint. God bless mom.
Right.
But dad, when I came back to music 20 years ago, he was borderline throw myself off the cliff for those moments when your son tells you he's going to be a jazz musician.
Right.
And he could only say, you're a lawyer, you're a French professor with a PhD, and you're going to be a jazz musician? I'm heartbroken.
That's the oldest story in the book. Right?
It's an old story.
Yeah.
But just towards the end of his life, so he passed about 10 years ago, he came to a show I did at a club, actually with this group, with the Symphonica group, and it was packed, and we had a great reception that night. And he calls me the next day, and he says, Ronnie, I was at your show last night. And I said, I know, Dad. I introduced you to the whole audience.
Yeah.
And he pauses and he says, not bad. And that's when I knew Dad was good. You know, he was about a year away from his end, and I think it ended well, right?
Right. And I think that's a good place to leave it. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mark Wigmore, for everything that you do.
That is it. Great to speak with Ron, and I'm glad his old man came around, right? Ron will be performing with his ensemble Symphronica this Saturday, February 15th, and then again on May 23rd at the Bathurst Center for Culture. That's 918 Bathurst Street in downtown Toronto. Tickets and info at bemusenetwork.com or his website, rondavismusic.com. Thank you once again to our sponsors today, Red Eye Media and the Great Crows Theater. And thank you to you. Thanks for checking out the show. Please do get in touch. Say hello. We do have a Art at the End of the World Facebook page. We have a Twitter page at Art at the End. And my Instagram handle, Mark Wigmore, is at Wigdad. We're back on Monday with one of my favorite people to talk to and a true auteur of documentary film, Alan Zweig, and looking forward to having Alan here in the studios. We'll speak to you then and for as long as we can.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.